Up, Up, and Away, Episode 28, Superman for All Seasons, Book 1, Spring. Hello and welcome to Up, Up, and Away, the weekly podcast dedicated to anything and everything Superman. I am your host, Mario Benessi. Wow, it feels really good to say that again. It's been quite a long time since I've said that at the beginning of each show, and for good reason, because there was a period of time where I didn't do this show weekly. But I'm back at it again, and I love doing it. It's almost been about 10 episodes since I've started doing my weekly thing again. And it's just so good to be back on the mic this frequently. I love it, and it's showing in my ratings numbers. I mean, yeah, I'm not the most popular podcast out there, but I'm still doing pretty well for myself, I'd like to think. On Podomatic, I'm getting closer to reaching the record, or at least my personal record, of being number 15 in over 3,000 podcasts. So that's great for me. I'm coming up pretty close. Last time I checked for episode 27, that put me at, I think, number 27 on the list, which is pretty good. Of course, the numbers fall as, you know, because it's on a daily ranking, I guess. So I get my numbers for each day and where I rank both in the overall podcast section and in the literature section. So it might have fallen a couple points since then, but doing the show more regularly has definitely helped keep me closer to the top position. So, you know, I really like that. It feels good to know that people are actually listening to my show. And, you know, maybe there are only a couple of people listening to shows on Podomatic in general. But to be able to say that, yeah, for, you know, I was at this particular ranking for a period of time, it feels good to say. In other news, Batman v Superman, my copy of it, finally came in the mail. It only took, 2 weeks? But yeah, it came into the mail, and I was so excited about it, and there was a whole long process with it. The mailroom over at FAU, just not the best. It's not like getting a package at your house, where the shipper says that the package was delivered, or the package tracking says that it was delivered at your house and you go right outside and it's on your doorstep. No, you actually have to go and you wait for an email to come to your school email address saying that your package has arrived and that you can go and pick it up and sign for it. But that takes like a day for them to process the package. Sometimes if it's a good day, you might get it on the same day that it's delivered, but most days you're probably just going to be waiting for the very next day to get it. And of course they have limited hours on Saturday, so they go from like, I think maybe like 11 p.m. to maybe like 2 in the afternoon. So very, very brief window to get your packages on Saturday. But it came on, what was it, last Friday, and they sent me an email. And I've been waiting for this email all day because I had checked on Amazon and said my package was delivered, so it was going to be there today. And it was about 11 in the morning, so I'm like, all right, I have a pretty good chance of getting this today. If not, it'll be tomorrow that I get it. And so I got the email, and it said that my package was there, and it was already checked in, and I could go downstairs and pick it up. Now, I live on the 7th floor in this building that I'm currently in. And so I go down, I take the elevator, and of course, every time you use the elevator, you need to go downstairs. Of course, like all 6 or all 5 of the other floors, they have to use the elevator too, because apparently taking the stairs from the 2nd or 3rd floor down is just absolutely inconceivable to some people, or people that are going from like the 6th floor to the 5th floor and they take the elevator and they can't take 10-15 extra seconds or so and just take the stairs down to the floor below. No, they gotta wait for the elevator and waste somebody else's time. But anyway, so I go downstairs, and I go to the mailroom. The mailroom guy isn't there. The mailroom is still open. It's still open for the day. He's just not there. So another person that lives in the building comes up, and they're asking, you know, do you know what's going on? Where's the mailroom guy? And I'm like, I honestly don't know. So they go and ask the person at the front desk in the lobby. And they come back and they say, all right, well, the guy, he went to go take his lunch break. He'll be back about 1:30-ish. I'm like, all right. So I go back upstairs and I kill time for about 40, 45 minutes or so. And then I go back downstairs and I get the package. And I'm so excited. And, of course, everybody wants to take the elevator up. So I got to make stops on 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 before I can actually get to 7 because people want to use the elevator. And so I get to my room and I unpackage it, and the statue is awesome. Long story short, the statue is awesome. I have a couple of problems with it. If you really want to see what it looks like, I put a review up on my YouTube channel. My channel's name is GuitarMan122508. That's all one, it's not really a word, but it's all one thing. No spaces, no underscores. GuitarMan122508. And I put a review up on that, and I really like it. I mean, it does have its problems. The S-Shield is a teeny bit sloppy. It could have been a little bit tighter on the paintwork and the forehead. It's a little too large. The face sculpt is serviceable. It's not a dead-on ringer for Henry Cavill, but it looks great. I like it. It's very wonderfully sculpted, and a lot of attention to detail was put into this, so I really appreciate it. And, of course, it came with a copy of the Ultimate Edition on Blu-ray. So, I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch the Ultimate Cut yet. And that kind of makes me sad, especially because for the next 2 weeks I'm going to be really busy with training for next year for the RA position, which is kind of ridiculous because I already know how to do my job. But it's whatever, it comes with the territory. But I'm going to try and sit down maybe this weekend and watch it. I should be able to do it. I just got a lot on my plate the next 2 weeks, but I'm definitely going to get an episode out to you guys both this week and next week. That's not going to change. I will make time for this because I absolutely need this. One, because I promised it to you and I try to be a man of my word, and two, because I need something to keep me sane. I'm going to be doing training from 8 in the morning to 8 p.m. every day from the 5th to the 17th, and then afterwards I have to do work inside the building, and a lot of it is like making decorations and stuff for the halls so that it's got like a theme, but they want it all to be FAU themed, and it's pretty much just red and blue and like gray, so that should be really easy to do. If I need to, I can reuse some of my old decorations, so I can make time for this. I just need something to keep my sanity because it was a very long, very grueling 2 weeks last year, and I didn't try to make an episode during those 2 weeks. I don't even remember really doing much outside of trying to keep myself together. Very early mornings, I'm not a morning person at all. Anything earlier than like 10:30 is really early for me. And yeah, that's kind of bad because I've got to start entering the real world really soon. And, you know, jobs start pretty early, but I'm more of a night owl. I record all my episodes at night. I just think better. I work better during the late night hours. Right now, it's about midnight right now. Actually, it just turned midnight upon recording this episode. So I just work better at night. But enough rambling. We need to have a serious talk. Okay, so Tuesday, maybe? We got the first picture of Tyler Hoechlin as Superman for the Supergirl TV show that is going to be on CW. And people are just absolutely losing their minds over this thing. There are some people that really like the suit and think that Tyler's going to do a pretty good job in the role. And I have a few minor complaints about the suit, most notably the belt. It just looks a little bit weird. But the promotional picture that they put out with him, he wasn't in the best stance, and it wasn't the very best representation of what this guy could bring to the role. And it wasn't until we started getting pictures of what the guy looks like in the suit on set, you know, doing the filming for the series, that people start to change their tune. It's like, all right, he looks a little bit more Superman-ish. And then we get to see him do a shirt rip, and we get to see him with the Daily Planet building in the background. And it all looks good. I think it looks very good. But there are some people that just cannot let things go. And I'm not here to cast aspersions on any section of the Superman community. But I found that for some stupid reason, a lot of Superman fans just cannot let things go. And it's really frustrating. And I've been through so many comment sections on the official Superman page where they posted the picture, on the group for the Superman homepage, and multiple collector groups for Superman-related memorabilia on Facebook. And every one of them, there were at least 25 people nagging and complaining, oh, why couldn't Tom Welling come back and do the role of Superman? Well, it's not Superman to me because it's not Christopher Reeve. Oh, that doesn't look like Superman. He doesn't look like Superman. It's obviously going to be garbage. No. First off, Tom Welling said he is not coming back to the role. As much as I enjoyed his stint on Smallville, he had 10 years to play Kal-El. That is more than enough time for him to play the role, and as much as I'd like to see him put the suit on, instead of having him have it CG'd on him, it's not going to happen. Secondly, as much as we love Christopher Reeve, and as wonderful as his performance was in the four Superman films and then his appearances on Smallville, he's gone. He passed away 12 years ago. He's not coming back, and the best thing that we can do is honor his memory by continuing the role of the character through actors who embody the characteristics of who Superman is, because Christopher Reeve was a Superman. He is undoubtedly a real-life Superman, and he was taken from us way too soon, and what happened to him was a tragedy, but it's time to let go. His Superman exists in a very special place in both our hearts and in history. It exists in that period from 1978 to 1987. Trust me, I love Christopher Reeve, don't get me wrong. But you can't just say that every person who isn't Christopher Reeve is automatically not Superman. Which leads me into the next point. Just because he doesn't look like Christopher Reeve or George Reeves or Henry Cavill or Tom Welling or Kirk Allen or Ray Middleton or Johnny Rockwell or John James Newton or Gerard Christopher doesn't mean that they are not capable of being Superman. Superman is an ideal, and, you know, we haven't even seen a single shred of footage of Tyler Hoechlin as Superman. He could bring it hardcore to the role. He could bring something that maybe very few actors have brought to the role before. I doubt it, because, I mean, Superman's been around for close to 80 years. I'm pretty sure that almost every aspect of the character that he could bring has been brought to some incarnation of the character in one way or another, you know? Just to automatically deem him unworthy of putting on the suit, that's just ludicrous to me. We haven't seen any single bit of footage. And you'd think that people would learn by now. You know, we've had so many people prove us wrong on casting choices. Ben Affleck as Batman. People thought he was going to be garbage. One of the things that people said about Batman v Superman, love it or hate it, was that he did really well in the role. And that he is a really good Batman. Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. People thought she was going to be garbage. People are pumped about her movie now because she put on a great performance. Heath Ledger's Joker. Oh, you can't have the guy from A Knight's Tale or from 10 Things I Hate About You. You can't have him play the Joker. Everybody praises his Joker now. I'm still hard-pressed to find somebody that didn't at least appreciate his performance. Michael Keaton as Batman. Oh, you can't have Mr. Mom play Batman. That's just stupid. People love Michael Keaton Batman. They're playing his movie again on the big screen in Cinemark next week. This is still a relevant movie that people still gravitate towards because Michael Keaton brings it as Batman. Grant Gustin as The Flash. Oh, he was on Glee. He has no idea on how to really act or anything. Still a really good Flash. He brought it as The Flash. He knows what he's doing. My point is, unless you've seen a single piece of footage for Tyler Hoechlin as Superman, reserve your judgment. And another thing I've seen is people saying, oh, that's a stupid costume. The suit doesn't necessarily make the man. And yeah, there are points in comic book history where the suit did detract from who this character was. For example, the Truth storyline where Superman was wearing jeans and a t-shirt and no cape. That didn't really scream Superman to me, and that's because he wasn't really written to be Superman. It was a very disappointing point in the modern Superman continuity, but people are complaining about the stupidest things. He's got a blue suit, doesn't he? Well, yeah. He's got a red cape, doesn't he? Well, yeah. He's got red boots, right? Yeah, they're red. Okay. Well, does he look like Superman? Yeah, it looks like a Superman costume. Okay. Well, then... Well, I still don't like it, because it's got these weird attachments for the cape. Just shut up already. Just... Shut up, okay? If your main complaint about the costume is the way that the cape is attached, then that's stupid. You're going to judge an entire actor's performance before you've seen any piece of his acting based on a single aesthetic point on a costume. People were complaining about the Flash's symbol having red instead of the white. You know what they did? They changed it from season 1 to season 2. Costumes can change. It's just so frustrating sometimes being a comic book fan, because no matter what they do, there's always going to be somebody complaining about it, and then it just starts this whole avalanche of stupidity. That's what it is. It's stupidity. And it's the same thing with the whole thing about the Suicide Squad movie. I haven't seen the film yet. I cannot adequately say if it's a good film or not. I know that it looks like fun, and I'm probably going to have a good time at the film, but the reviews that I've seen are absolutely stupid, and people are writing it off as a horrible film. But the film doesn't come out until Thursday at the earliest for a general audience, and people are already claiming that it's a garbage film. Wait till you see the film first before you pass judgment, guys. It shouldn't be this difficult of a concept to grasp. If you haven't seen something, you cannot pass judgment. You have to experience it before you can adequately say whether you enjoyed it or not. It's like saying, oh, I hate chicken nuggets. Well, have you ever had a chicken nugget? No, but I hate them. That's stupid. Your reasoning is that of a 5-year-old. Sometimes people are stupid, and unfortunately, you can't necessarily fix stupid. And it's really frustrating. It's really, really frustrating. The best thing we can really do is just show that we enjoy things. And somewhere along the line, people forgot to enjoy things. And yeah, there are definitely products that are put out that are just bad or mediocre or less than stellar, or less than what the fans deserve, or things that completely miss the mark on both storyline or what the characters are about and who they should be. And yeah, it's perfectly fine to call studios out and companies out when they make those mistakes, because that way we can get the better products in the long run, because they hear what we're saying. They need to pick up what we're laying down. But to just jump to these irrational conclusions without any sort of experiencing of these items or these films or shows or books, it's stupid to me. When did we stop enjoying things? Why does everything have to be so nitpicky, you know? And this isn't a defense of all things that are considered terrible. I realize that Batman v Superman isn't a great film. It's not a cinematic masterpiece by any means. I'm not claiming that it is. I enjoyed it, but I also saw why people didn't enjoy it. And it's gotten to this point where you either love something or you hate something. There's no in-between. There's no, oh, it was just okay. You either adore it or you despise it and you want it to burn and the company to burn down with it. It's so hostile. It's so hostile on both sides. I know there are people that are just negative all the time, and they can't say a positive thing about anything, you know, because heaven forbid you actually enjoy something. But it's gotten to this point where it's just so uncomfortable to be around. So, I don't know, it's just food for thought. It's just something that's been kind of bothering me lately, and it's time that we moved on from the past and looked to the future. We can enjoy things that are new while still holding dear to us things that came from the past. It's not an impossible feat. You can love both. Just like you can love Coke and Pepsi, which I'd Coke all the way. Or you can love DC and Marvel. You know, you can love old and new. There's nothing wrong with that. If it appeals to you, fine. Enjoy it. If it doesn't appeal to you, well, at least give it a fair shake, because you might be surprised. So before we jump into the meat of this episode, I'm going to take a real quick break, and then we'll jump into book one of Superman for All Seasons.
Up, up, and away!
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman. You may know me from the Green Lantern podcast, The Lantern Cast. You also may know me from making promises across the comics podcasting community concerning a new project I've been working on. An Action Comics Weekly podcast, to be precise. Well, it's time to deliver on that promise. The Action Comics Weekly podcast is a bi-weekly podcast featuring myself and a rotating cast of semi-regular co-hosts discussing the characters appearing in the comic series of the same name from the late 1980s. So, starting this summer, join me and Mark Marble as we discuss Green Lantern.
For all the people that want to give Hal, when he was Parallax, a lot of shit about the way he acted, Star Sapphire has nothing on Hal for being, like, pushed over the borderline, because she's just completely friggin' nuts.
Jay Jones as we discuss Wild Dog.
He straight up, like you said, he murders these people. And that's not my DC Comics. That's not superheroic at all. Batman wouldn't have killed anybody. But this story is it's not bad. It's not great. It's like the character himself. It's like it's just there. It just exists.
Ben Avery, as we discuss The Secret Six.
So when I read this alone, as I was reading through this issue, I'm thinking, what am I getting myself into? Because I told Chad I'd do this, but I don't know if I'm going to like this. I do end up liking Secret Six more. This is the introduction. And without this, you know, I probably wouldn't like, you know, the second chapter as much.
Doug Zavisha, as we discuss Dead Man.
Well, it's a kind of a waffly Dead Man story. It wants to be a Dead Man story. It starts to be a Dead Man story. It forgets it's a Dead Man story. And then it comes back to being one. All in the span of 8 pages.
Alan Middleton, as we discuss Blackhawk.
That there's sort of this era of Blackhawk where he was sort of dissolute and sort of couldn't get civilian life together. Mm-hmm. And I think this story is either beginning that trend or at least tapping into that fertile story.
And Michael Bailey, as we discuss Superman.
There is really no way to tie this two-page strip into that. So it really exists in its own world at a time where the Superman books were becoming more and more linked. So it's this oddity on a number of levels.
And many other characters featuring many more guest hosts along the way. The Action Comics Weekly Podcast, coming soon, summer 2016. Find us on Facebook for more details.
Welcome back. So this episode, we're going to be starting a four-episode coverage of Superman for All Seasons. It's written by Jeff Loeb and drawn by Tim Sale. It's one of my absolute favorite Superman stories of all time. This was started in September of 1998, and it's only four issues, obviously, since we're doing four-episode coverage of this. But it's just such a beautiful piece. If you have it, feel free to read along. And honestly, you really should be looking at this. The art is just phenomenal. It's so gorgeous. I love looking at every panel in this book. It's a Norman Rockwell painting with speech bubbles. It's important to note that each book has a theme of seasons, the first book being spring, the next book after that summer, the third book being fall, and the fourth book being winter. So this takes place over the course of almost an entire year. And each book is narrated by a different person in Superman's life, the first book being narrated by Jonathan Kent. So I will be reading Jonathan's narrations just because it does add more depth to the story than me just narrating what's going on the panels. So let's begin. Folks tend to call him the Man of Steel nowadays. I guess that he's the most famous person in the world. Not that he ever was interested in being famous in the first place. Able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, change the course of mighty rivers, faster than a speeding bullet. We knew he was special, but people will talk. Believe it or not, there was a time before all that, when he was just a man's son. Okay, and so we see Clark calling out for Jonathan Kent, and it's evening time at the Kent farm. And we see Jonathan riding a tractor, and he's trying to remove a boulder that's obstructing his path and preventing crops from growing. One night, years ago, a terrible whistling, loudest thing you ever heard, came out of the sky. We drove over to the north field and found some kind of rocket ship. To this day, I can't think of any other way to describe it. Inside it, there was a baby. A baby. And Clark says that it's time for Jonathan to come in, it's time for supper. And not a scratch on him. Never mind what kind of a fool puts a baby in a rocket in the first place. It takes an entirely different kind of thinking to then decide to keep the child and call it your own. Jonathan's struggling to remove the boulder, and Clark's just standing behind him looking on. But that's Martha for you. Stubborn as a mule. Twice as set in her ways. Wonderful woman. Marry her all over again tomorrow if that's what she wanted. Clark asks to help, and Jonathan tells them that he's going to need some sort of leverage to lift the boulder out of the ground, and Clark just lifts it out because he's Kryptonian and he's got these kind of powers. The boy's got a lot of Martha in him, and let's leave it at that. Jonathan gives Clark a bit of a disapproving look, and he walks away telling Clark that they'd better get in for supper. So the Kents and Lana Lang and her Aunt Ruth are all sitting around the table, and Clark's feeding the dog scraps. A very beautiful picture, and Martha's prepared a ham for dinner. It was springtime in Kansas. Clark was finishing out his last year in high school. Seemed like only yesterday he was that baby in that rocket. After dinner, Lana asks Clark why he was being so quiet at dinner, and Clark's got a lot on his mind, and Lana asks him that if there were anything ever on his mind that he needed to talk about, if he would come to her, and he says, yeah, who else would I tell? After Lana and Ruth leave, Jonathan and Martha are having a conversation on the porch about Clark and how he's getting stronger and how they aren't sure exactly which steps to take next. Springtime in Kansas meant it was planting time. And the funny part about planting was that no matter how many times you plowed the same field, suddenly you'd hit a rock you'd never found there before, but had been there all along. And so they continue to talk about Clark and his abilities and what to do next. And they come to the conclusion that, well, he's probably going to be all right since they raised him right. And Martha asks Jonathan if he thinks that Clark can hear them. And then Jonathan says that, well, Clark's asleep and his room's all the way on the other side of the house. And we get this beautiful transition between the Kents talking and the dialogue bubbles kind of lifting up towards a window on the other side of the house and through the window, and we see Clark just sitting in bed with a dog listening. The next day, Clark, Lana, and Pete Ross are all heading down to the Smallville General Store, and it's a very sunny day, and Lana asks Clark what he's going to do once summer starts, and Pete says that he's going to move to Metropolis, and he's getting out of there. He doesn't want to be in Smallville anymore. Sometimes when the corn was planted, it shot up too soon. The roots hadn't taken hold, so the stalk couldn't support its own weight. The corn would turn sour. I don't know if Clark knew how lucky he was growing up in a place like Smallville. Clark had known Lana Lang all his life. Her Aunt Ruth, difficult as it was, raised her right. Martha always said Lana had set her cap on being with Clark, but I never saw it. P. Pete Ross, on the other hand, was the sort of kid that went down like castor oil. Little went a long way. And so the three walk into the general store, and we see a couple guys playing cards, and they're talking about a twister that's supposed to be coming through town in the next couple days. Ed Carlman took over the general store after his father passed on, and Winston ran the feed and grain. Tom Landers was the fix-it man and the town know-it-all. Caleb Stone had the place up the road, twice the size of ours and half the luck. Morris Clue worked over at the filling station. Bert drove delivery. Clark knew them all, and they all knew Clark. That was Smallville. Pete Ross wishes for $1 million. Kind of reminds me of that little bit in It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart in the general store, and he says, "I wish I had $1 million, hot dog." You know that bit? But yeah, it reminds me of that. And except he's rubbing on an elephant head, like a little bronze elephant statue. And Lana asks him, "Why do you always rub on that thing? And besides, what would you even do if you had $1 million? And Pete says, "I know what I'd do. I wouldn't be giving it away like that Lex Luthor over in Metropolis." And Lana asks Clark if he thinks that there really is a Lex Luthor, or if he's just somebody that the newspaper made up. All of a sudden, Clark remembers that he's supposed to get a haircut that day, so Clark rushes out of the general store and into a barbershop, where he takes a seat and he's waiting for the barber to cut his hair. Like I said, there was just so much we didn't know about Clark. With those powers and abilities that didn't seem to have any limitations, and at that moment, Clark uses his X-ray vision against his own will, so it just kind of kicks on. And he sees Lana and Pete over in the general store, and they're talking. And Lana asks Pete if he thinks that Clark was in his own little world today, or if he was just kind of out of it. And Pete says that Clark's always in his own world. So the barber goes to cut Clark's hair, and the scissors break. So Clark rushes out of the barber shop, and the barber makes a comment. He's like, he doesn't even think that it's Clark's hair that's the problem. He thinks it's the scissors, that they're not making them like they used to. Sam Wilson was the sort of man who made everybody's business his own, even when he didn't have the right to. Chief Parker, on the other hand, had the right to, but believed in letting folks go about their business. Lana sees Clark running down the sidewalk, and in a scene very reminiscent of Superman the movie, we see Clark racing alongside of a train and then jumping across the tracks right as the train is supposed to, you know, would have come and hit him. Back at the Kent farm, Martha calls Jonathan and just kind of draws his attention to the fact that Clark's been standing out in the field just looking out there. So Jonathan goes out there to talk to Clark, and Clark tells Jonathan that he's scared. "There are things about being a father I'd remember for all my days. How I held him in my arms as a baby. Awkward to start, like carrying a chicken, and then finally getting the hang of it. The morning I found him standing up in his crib for the very first time, just busting with pride with a smile as big as the moon. Watching him push back the screen door and toddle out on his own into the yard, talking to the dog and the ants and the porch swing. The more I thought about those things, the more I thought of Clark as a normal boy. But my son could bend steel in his bare hands. And as much as I wanted to tell him that all the answers in life and the next could be found in Smallville, all I could promise Clark was that his mother and I would love him. Always." And so the twister that was mentioned earlier starts coming through Smallville. It's tearing things up pretty bad. Now, I don't put too much stake in being a church-going sort. That was more Martha's way. Myself, I never doubted that Mother Nature could level the playing field when needed. With the twister coming in, Jonathan tells Martha that he's got to get the animals out of the barn and that they should go into the shelter, and Martha's asking where Clark is. Clark is in the middle of the field as the tornado is starting to strike. "We got to till the land, sow the fields, and reap the bounty. Every now and then, there had to be a price." And just like that, Clark is swept up in the tornado. And he's freaking out and he's screaming for his father. And he has this moment of realization that he can handle this. We see Morris, the gas station attendant. He's just kind of helpless at this point. He can't get away, really, because the twister is coming at him pretty fast, and the gas nozzles, they're spraying gasoline everywhere, so it could end very badly for him. "There are so few things a person can really be sure of. But I believe in the wild trouble of that moment, our son became a man." So Clark swoops down, and he grabs Morris out of harm's way just as the tornado hits the gas station and it explodes. And he uses his body to shield Morris. The Twister eventually calms down and leaves. Smallville is just terribly damaged at this point. It's looking real bad. Morris starts to question if Clark had actually flown down to save him, and then he thinks, no, that's silly. That was the tornado. The tornado lifted you and pushed you towards me, and it was a streak of luck that I happened to not get killed in this. And Clark says that he's got to get home. So he rushes home, and he's looking for his parents, and he thinks he's lost them until they pop out of the storm shelter beneath the house, and he just holds them tight. The Kent farm isn't looking too great either. The tractors and the side of the roof, very messy situation. So Clark helps clean the situation up. He takes the tractor out of the side of the roof, and he starts thinking that maybe he could have done more to help. Maybe fewer people could have gotten hurt, and less property damage could have been brought by this Twister if he had been able to intervene. And he says that he could have done more. I know, my son. It would haunt him from that day on. So one day, Clark goes to talk to the pastor at the church, and he's asking him what he should do. He's got a lot on his mind with graduation and the next steps, and you know, he doesn't want to say anything but his abilities. And the pastor says, well, you should probably go talk to your parents. They're probably going to be a little more helpful than I am in this situation. You know, they're the people that raised you. And then Clark asks the pastor, well, what if one man could have helped stop all the destruction? And the pastor says that it's probably not very likely that one man would have been able to stop all the destruction. You know, it's God's will. And then Clark asks again, well, what if one man could have stopped it? The pastor gets distracted and he's got to take care of something, and Clark understands. As spring ended, Clark graduated from Smallville High. As with most things, life went on. The Twister had passed. The town was being rebuilt. Martha had already taken Clark to buy a new suit. We brought suitcases down from the attic. I never thought about our time together until it grew too short. Now one night, Clark is taking Lana out into the middle of nowhere, practically. They're just hanging out in a field. And he tells Lana to take his hands, and they begin flying. And Lana, of course, freaks out. This is very scary and incredible to see that the person that you've grown up with your entire life can suddenly fly. But they go flying around Smallville. And he tries to explain to her that he needs to go leave Smallville so he can help people and use his abilities for good. And as much as she doesn't want to see him go, she understands, and she kisses him goodbye. The next morning, Clark's all dressed up, and he's got a suitcase, and he's talking to his mother, and they're sitting on the porch swing. And Martha tells him that he can do anything he sets his mind to as long as he believes in it with all of his heart. And it's a beautiful picture. It's very Norman Rockwell. My stomach rumbled all day long. Martha and I had done our job. We brought him up right. And all that meant to me now was our only son was old enough to say goodbye. And Jonathan's standing out in the middle of the field, and he's watching the sun rise, and Clark approaches him. We get this gorgeous, gorgeous two-page splash. And Clark asks Jonathan if he ever gets tired of looking at the sunrise. He says, no, never have. Guess I never will. It's a beautiful picture. If you can look at it right now, or if you Google it, it will take your breath away. It's one of the most beautiful pictures in this entire book. And so we arrive in Metropolis. Time passes. The country mouse leaves Smallville and becomes a city mouse. I never cared for Metropolis much. Can't see the horizon unless you're flying over it. Maybe that's why Clark chose to settle there after all. And so at this point, Clark has gotten a job at the Daily Planet, and Perry's barking orders to get more stories on Superman. You know the whole deal. They're an interesting bunch. Perry White, the gruff city editor. Jimmy Olsen, the eager kid photographer. And Lois Lane, his rival reporter. Clark has his work cut out for him. Clark tries to ask if Lois wants to hang out, and Lois says that she's already got plans with Lex Luthor. So later that night, Lex and Lois are hanging out. I guess they're getting back from a date or something. And Lex asks her pretty much to come upstairs, and Lois says no, that she's got an early deadline. And at that moment, a red, blue, and yellow streak just zooms past them and tosses Lex's hat off of his head. And then Lois says, and you've got a hat to catch. Now elsewhere we see a little boy on the ledge of a building, and he's chasing his cat. And he falls. But before it's too late for him, that same red, blue, and yellow streak zooms past him and grabs him and puts him back on the ledge. And it's Superman. And the kid says, "Wow, cool costume." Superman says, "Thanks. My mom made it for me." And he flies off. At the end of the day, I'm not sure we're all that different from any other parents. We worry about our son. That he's eating right. That he's making friends. That he'll stay out of harm's way. Even if he is Superman. And we see Superman flying past LexCorp Towers, and Lex is brooding about this new powerful figure that's pretty much come to, in his eyes, take away his power and his importance in Metropolis. Again, I cannot say how much I love this story. It's so beautifully written. It fully captures the essence of Superman, and it really pulls at your heartstrings, you know? And it's been a couple of years since I've read this, and it really should be an annual thing for me that I read this, just because it's a great coming-of-age story, it's a great Superman story, it's just a great story in general. It's a fine piece of fiction, but it really hits home, especially now with me getting closer and closer to leaving college and having to go out on my own and really become my own person. You know, and leaving home. I'm leaving home at this point. And hearing this narration from Jonathan Kent about his son leaving home, you know, that really puts it all into perspective. You know, when you're young, you just get so wrapped up in your own plans for life, and you just kind of, not necessarily forget, but you just don't exactly put it to the forefront that, you know, your parents have to say goodbye to you too. This isn't just a one-sided thing. This isn't a one-way street. Both of you are saying goodbye, and it's not goodbye forever. It's, well, hopefully it's not goodbye forever. It's until we meet again. And it's a big step in every person's life that they all have to come to at one point or another. And some people come to it a lot sooner than others. But at the end of the day, you know, we all have to go out into the world and find ourselves. You know, and at the risk of getting too personal, it just hits really close to home for me. With Clark realizing that he can't stay in Smallville, I'm feeling that exact same thing about my hometown. You know, it's still my hometown. It's always going to hold a special place in my heart. But I can't go back there. I really can't go back there, because the things that I want to do with my life, I'd blink my eyes and I'd be 50. And I know I can do so much more if I leave that place and I go to a place where I can really use my talents to do something with my life. And that's how Clark feels. So it's a very human story, and it really tugs at your heartstrings, and it gets a lot more emotional as we go on, especially when we get to the last couple chapters. The chapter where Clark returns home to Smallville, it's beautiful. There's just so much to this story, and it really should be on the top 10 stories for every Superman fan.
Up, up, and away!
Okay, doing the new promo. Do not say take the dare. Do not say take the dare. Okay, go. Hello, darling. Nice to see ya. It's me, J. David Weider, the Conway Twitty of podcasting. But please call me Dave. I host a show called Dave's Daredevil Podcast, where I talk about Marvel's Man Without Fear and Netflix superstar Daredevil. But I'm here to tell you that things have changed. Don't worry, I've still got more hornhead goodness than you can shake a billy club at and a desperado love for Daredevil. And episodes of the show still come out each and every Sunday. But now, Dave's Daredevil Podcast is part of the Two True Freaks Podcast Network. That's right, the show can now be found at twotruefreaks.com, home of Earth's mightiest podcasts. And if you haven't tried the show before, I see the want to in your eyes. So take the time to check out Dave's Daredevil Podcast, because sometimes you need a podcaster with a slow hand. Dave's Daredevil Podcast, every Sunday at twotruefreaks.com. Take the dare. I have no self-control.
I believe I plant myself a garden. All right, this episode's Adventures of Superman episode is entitled The Secret of Superman. And the synopsis is once again written by James Lance over at the Superman homepage. If you haven't checked that out, do so now, because he's very insightful and there's a lot of information in his review section. The original broadcast date is November 17th, 1952. It's written by Wells Root, directed by Tommy Carr, stars George Reeves as Superman / Clark Kent, Phyllis Coates as Lois Lane, Jack Larson as Jimmy Olsen, John Hamilton as Perry White, Robert Shane as Inspector Henderson, Peter Bracco as Dr. H.L. Ort, Larry J. Blake as Rush the Henchman, Helen Wallace as Mrs. Olsen, Jimmy's mother, Joel Friedkin as Herman the Waiter, Stephen Carr as the Cook, Margia Dean as the Agency Woman, Al Hill as Sam, Walter McGrail as a Newsman, Joey Ray as a Newsman, Frank J. Scannell as the Sergeant, and Sid Tomac as the Undercover Police Detective. It is after 1 o'clock a.m. in Metropolis. Clark Kent has received a telephone call that has awakened him. Jimmy Olsen's mother is very worried as Jimmy has not come home. He had contacted his mother at 5 o'clock p.m. and normally stops off at Jerry's Diner, but according to Mrs. Olsen, it's closed at this hour. Clark reassures her that Jimmy's probably found a scoop for the Daily Planet on the way home. Clark calls the office of editor Perry White. However, he is suddenly disconnected when someone hangs up. Now, Clark is also preoccupied, and he has a right to be. He's found Jimmy in a trance-like state. The last thing the Cub reporter remembers when Clark snaps him out of it is sitting next to a person in Jerry's Diner. Someone had brought Jimmy back to the Daily Planet and had forced open the chief's locked filing cabinet. Worse yet, the folder containing information on Superman is missing. Someone sinister clearly wants to learn the secrets of the Man of Steel. Perry White is staying in room 322 of the Metropolis News Club. A waiter named Herman is about to bring him a sandwich and coffee when two men attack him and steal the tray. One of them, Dr. H.L. Ort, is now in White's room serving the editor and placing something in his hot beverage. It puts White under the man's control, which allows Dr. Ort to ask about the Superman file. He wants to know who the last son of Krypton really is. Perry doesn't know the answer. Plus, the injured Herman has entered, suddenly followed by two newsmen. In the confusion, Ort escapes, learning nothing new that he can use against Superman. Clark Kent has been able to get Perry out of the influence of Dr. Ort's drug. Both he and Police Inspector Bill Henderson have been questioning the editor about the night's events. Unfortunately, Perry remembers nothing after the false waiter had given him his coffee. Analysis of the drink shows that sodium amytal, a truth serum that also rids a person of his or her free will, was placed in the drink. Clearly, someone is looking for information on Superman through the Daily Planet staff. Henderson wants everyone at the newspaper that has had contact with the last son of Krypton under constant police protection. Clark respectfully declines because he has a plan that will help bring these nefarious characters out into the open. Now it will be Superman's turn to learn more about Dr. H.L. Ort. As part of his plot to bring Dr. Ort out into the open, Clark has been fired from the Daily Planet. Ort's henchman, Roush, observes Kent as he asks Sam, a lunch wagon owner, for something to eat. Clark owes Sam $2 for food that was given to him these past days. Roush pays for everything Clark has eaten and offers him a job. At the same time, the gangster slips some sodium amytal in Kent's coffee. Jimmy Olsen and the policeman following the Cub reporter witness this from an alley not far away. To prevent Clark from being drugged, the detective and Jimmy attack Roush. Inspector Henderson's man takes a bullet in the leg before he shoots Roush in the back. Clark takes Roush to Dr. Ort's residence at 26 Mason Street to help the criminal. In spite of Jimmy's interference, it looks like Clark will meet the mastermind who wishes to discover the secrets of Superman. As Jimmy follows Clark and calls Lois Lane for assistance, Dr. Ort is trying to remove the bullet from Roush's spine. He is unsuccessful. Roush is dead. However, the henchman succeeded in doing his job, bringing Clark Kent to Dr. Ort. He offers Kent a job while spiking a ginger ale with sodium amytal. Clark drinks it and has a blank, dazed look on his face soon afterwards. Clark is ordered to get rid of Roush's body. While doing this for the evil doctor, he is to think of everything he knows about Superman. It looks like Dr. H.L. Ort is another step closer to getting the Man of Tomorrow's secrets. Lois has entered Dr. Ort's home in search of Clark Kent. Ort tries pleasantries to disguise his true motives, but Lois doesn't believe him. He tells her the truth after slipping some sodium amytal into her coffee while she examines a bloodstain on the floor. Lois is currently under the influence of Ort's drug. Through his interrogation of Miss Lane, Ort is able to deduce the world's greatest secret. Clark Kent and Superman have never been seen together, thereby leaving Ort with only one conclusion. The mild-mannered reporter and the Man of Steel are one and the same. Now both Ort and Dazed Lois know of Kent's double life. Try as she might, Lois is unable to resist Dr. Ort's mind drug. She has been ordered to bring Jimmy, who has called Inspector Henderson, into the house. Henderson tells Clark, who has been recounting his experience with Ort and Roush, that Jimmy hung up before saying anything. Believing that there's trouble, Clark rushes back to Ort's home as Superman. He stops the mad doctor from killing Lois and Jimmy. Ort gets away as Jimmy passes out. Clark, you're Clark Kent, Lois says to Superman in a sodium amytal stupor. Stay with him, orders the shocked Caped Wonder while indicating Jimmy. Dr. Ort was shot and killed in a gun battle with the police outside of his home. Clark Kent has been able to revive Lois from the mind drug Ort had given her. She remembers nothing that occurred after she was given the sodium amytal-laced coffee. Superman's secret identity is once again safe, and Clark breathes a sigh of relief. What an episode. Wow. There's just so much awesome in this episode, and it's definitely an episode that I recommend very highly. It's very noirish, which is something that I'm always a fan of. There's not too much involved in like an action scene with Superman doing anything. It's mostly Clark Kent and the staff of the Daily Planet, and it's really cool. Clark's plan is actually pretty genius, and he doesn't really flat out tell Perry, all right, well, what I want you to do is fire me from the Daily Planet so I can go and get closer to this guy. No, he hints at it, and Perry figures it out, which is, I like that. I like that a lot. The only thing that I can really complain about is Ort's motives weren't very clear. Like, we really don't know why he wanted to know more about Superman. Maybe he just wanted to find out who Superman really was so he could expose him and hurt the people that are closest to him. Maybe he's trying to work with Superman. He says that he's got a job for Superman that he'd like to complete somewhere in the episode at the beginning, I'm pretty sure. But we're not entirely sure of what his motives are. So other than that, it's a very solid episode. Great acting, great writing, keeps you on the edge of your seat. I highly recommend it. So let's jump into this episode's entries from the Essential Superman Encyclopedia. The ones that we're covering for this episode are a bit long, mostly just Agent Liberty, and that's because he's done a lot more than some of these one-off characters. So let's begin. Agent Liberty. The superheroic identity of ex-CIA agent Ben Lockwood of the post-First Crisis Unified Earth. Lockwood had been left for dead when the anti-terrorist mission to which he had been assigned went awry. After surviving in hostile terrain for several months, Lockwood at last made his way back home, where he was forced to confront the bitter truth of how the agency had rewarded his service. His records had been erased. Indeed, all evidence of his having lived had been obliterated. As far as his government was concerned, there had never been a Ben Lockwood. With no one else who would verify his identity, in desperation, Lockwood sought out Jay Harriman, his former bureau chief, who had long since left the CIA. Lockwood had already become deeply disenchanted with the CIA's methods and the types of missions to which he was being assigned. And now that the agency had repudiated his very existence, Lockwood's disgust with and loss of faith in his country's leadership was absolute. Thus, he was receptive to Harriman's suggestion that he join the well-funded Sons of Liberty, a secret right-wing parliamentary group that shared Lockwood's extreme views. The SOL's membership was made up exclusively of rogue and disaffected members of the U.S. intelligence community. Assigned the codename Agent Liberty, Lockwood was equipped with a high-tech battlesuit made of highly resilient and flame-retardant materials, as well as gauntlets that could generate ordnance-deflecting force fields and deploy razor-sharp blades, all prototypes acquired, quote-unquote, by the SOL from the R&D labs of Black Ops departments. Agent Liberty was also fitted with a jetpack that allowed him to fly at the speed of an Apache helicopter, as well as a variety of sidearms and a helicopter backup team that acted as a lookout. For most of his career, Agent Liberty worked alone, fighting crime he perceived as resulting from federal law enforcement's incompetence or corruption. It was on one such occasion that the Man of Steel first encountered him in the course of one of Superman's many battles with Inner Gang, the notorious national crime syndicate once headquartered in Metropolis. That's in Superman, Volume 2, Number 60, October 1991. While Superman did not approve of Lockwood's vigilante methods, the two men nevertheless forged an uneasy alliance on a number of occasions, most notably when Liberty agreed to join the army of superheroes recruited by the Man of Steel to thwart Brainiac's use of Warworld to annihilate Earth. That's in Action Comics number 674, February 1992, and Superman Volume 2, number 65, March 1992, and others. The two heroes met repeatedly, despite the fact that Agent Liberty made Washington, D.C. his base of operations, especially after Clark Kent's boyhood friend Pete Ross became a U.S. Senator. When Ross was blackmailed by the Sons of Liberty into assassinating a former SOL leader-turned-whistleblower, Lockwood stole the gun from Ross, who had refused to go through with the crime, and did the deed himself. Lockwood escaped, but by the time he refused an order to execute Ross, he had long since begun questioning his loyalty to the Sons of Liberty. In short order, Lockwood discovered that the SOL had a long history of orchestrating assassinations. Spiraling out of control, Lockwood was driven by rage and a sense of betrayal to murder both Jay Harriman and the federal judge with whom Harriman had transformed the SOL into a death squad. At that point, Lockwood severed all ties with the organization and went underground, beginning a brief period as a fugitive, but not before breaking into the SOL's files, deleting all references to him, and turning the remaining documents over to Clark Kent at the Daily Planet. Agent Liberty later joined the Justice League of America for a short time after Superman had been killed by the alien monstrosity Doomsday in the hope that this membership could immunize him from any prosecution. But following a few JLA cases and a battle with Arclight after Superman's quote-unquote resurrection, Lockwood disappeared and was not seen again before the event known as the Infinite Crisis. During that reality-altering event, however, Agent Liberty was documented as serving among those crime fighters who united to prevent the society from conquering Metropolis, and that's Infinite Crisis number 6, May 2006. It was subsequently revealed that Liberty had come out of retirement to help provide security while the president went with Superman and the former citizens of Kandor, newly relocated to Earth. That's in Superman number 681, December 2008. Liberty was apparently killed by Superwoman when she discovered he was spying on Sam Lane and Lex Luthor. That's in Action Comics number 873, March 2009. Although his body was retrieved from Metropolis Harbor, it was mysteriously removed from Metropolis City Hospital before his suit, which had emitted a stress signal that could have helped identify his killer, could be removed or examined. Most recently, a female Agent Liberty joined the Secret Service to help protect the current U.S. president. As of this writing, no definitive documentation has established whether she was connected in any way with the late Ben Lockwood or involved with a new Earth incarnation of the Sons of Liberty. That's in Action Comics number 871 through 873, January through March 2009, and Supergirl Volume 5, 37 through 38, March through April 2009, and others. Ajax, a former Superman robot who achieved his greatest fame as Wonder Man. That's in Superman Volume 1, Number 163, August 1963. Akvar, and that just redirects us to Flamebird. And this episode's super fact is pretty interesting, and something that I hadn't known until I got my copy of Batman v Superman on Blu-ray. According to the Batman v Superman bonus featurette, The Might and the Power of a Punch, Superman's heat vision can reach temperatures of up to 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 5,500 degrees Celsius. And this episode's super quote comes from Mr. Henry Cavill. He's a very sincere guy, very genuine. I'd love to meet him one day, but this is him talking about being Superman. You can't be pissed off at the idea of playing Superman for the rest of your life. It's a wonderful role. There's a huge potential there for complex storytelling, and I'm looking forward to exploring those avenues. People think Kryptonite can beat him. No. The only thing that can really beat Superman is Superman, his own moral choices. When you have that to start with, the storytelling can really delve into something rich. Come on, it's Superman. Good night, folks.
Superman, don't you understand? We love you. Superman.
For more Up, Up, and Away, visit www.upupandaway.podomatic.com. The show and other Superman-related goodies can be found on Facebook by searching Up, Up, and Away Podcast, and Mario can be contacted through email at mbenesi94@yahoo.com. That's B as in boy, E-N-N-E-S-E. Up, Up, and Away is a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, and Superman and all related images are property of DC Comics and Warner Brothers Entertainment. All images and music are property of their respective owners, and no infringement is intended. This is a non-profit fan podcast. Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.